To each one of these sons, the unborn creator of the universe gave a part of his own body, which was characterized by deep meditation, mental concentration, supernatural power, austerity, austerity, adoration, and renunciation. Well, Lord Brahma, he is known as Aja, or unborn, or self-born, Swayambhu. He does not have a body made of gross elements. We have bodies made predominantly 60-70% water and various other elements. So we might think Brahma, on face value, a superficial person might read this and think, oh, Brahma, you know, cut something out of his gross body and gave it to his sons. But that's not what's intended here. First of all, Brahma has a body made of subtle elements, mind, intelligence, ego. It doesn't have a gross body. So when he imbues his sons, for example, his first sons were mental sons. They appeared from his forehead. Who knows who they were? Lord Shiva, Rudra, Narad Muni, Bhrigu. Neither he required a wife, nor he required to deplete himself in any way. We also, in some respects, do the same thing in our gross way. The seed of the male creates a child within the womb of the mother, and then the mother's fluid and the egg that is there, the seed and the egg produce a child, and that child is made up of the genes of both the male and the female. So in a way we are we're giving a part of our own body. And often parents look upon children, that's why they get so attached to children, because they think, oh, look, I have reincarnated as my son. It's me in small size. And you get very attached. But of course, when the child grows up and totally goes against everything you want him to do, then you realize that there's a different living entity there. Lord Brahma is one of the 12 Mahajans of the universe, one of the 12 great authorities in devotional service. He's the most powerful living being in charge of creation. So his, where did his power come from? It came from Krishna, of course, but he was instructed in tapasya. There we have three two main ways of acquiring knowledge or of receiving instruction. One is by seeing, we can learn. The other is by hearing. And then the third one is by experiencing. So one may see people engaged in devotional service and have enough intelligence to follow in their footsteps. The process of Krishna consciousness is one of following the previous acharyas. The path is the path of devotional service is not a whimsical path. It's not whatever you do, whatever path you follow, you can call it devotional service. Like the famous Bengali phrase, Jata Mat Tata Pat, as many ways as there are paths, one man, Ramakrishna, coined that phrase, Jata Mat Tata Pat. But, you know, that's so out of touch with reality. You can't just go to the airport and say, give me a ticket to anywhere, it'll all reach to the same destination anyway. You have to say, I want a ticket to London, and then you go to London. You have to describe your destination. You have to give a specific destination, or you're not going to go anywhere. So we are first learning about our destination, Krishna. Who is Krishna? What are his qualities? What are his characteristics? What are his pastimes? What are his unlimited features? Something about him. We learn. Then we can hope to achieve meditation on him. You can't just meditate on the void or on some unknown. First of all, it's very, very difficult. Avyakta sakta chetasam, avyakta hi gatir dukam, dehavad viravapite. How does that verse go? From the 12th chapter. Klesho dikataraṣṭeṣaṁ, klesho. People who try to meditate on something without any concept, some formless thing. 99% are just cheating themselves, fooling themselves. They're just, you can actually see it. It's not just we're saying it, but you go and experience it. You go to a yoga class, or just recently I was in an environment where everyone was encouraged to pray, and invariably there would be at least a dozen people in a crowd of maybe 100 who were just, they were supposed, and this was for, you know, half an hour or an hour, so people were praying, but you know, some just went to sleep. They could not close their eyes and stay awake. And we hear about people who practice yoga and meditate on a candle or meditate on some, imperceptible thing. How does a thing become imperceptible? That's what they think. It's very, very wonderful, because it's, you can't describe it. You can't. It's beyond description, but you're expected to meditate upon him. So Krishna says such persons, they only engage in useless labor, srama. Srama eva hi kevalam. Srama means useless labor. Klesho dikataraste. They simply, all they get from their so-called meditation, they're actually not doing meditation, first of all, especially today. They're doing imitation, not meditation, imitation. And even if they were expert at such so-called meditation, they can never they can never reach Krishna's lotus feet. They can never even come close, even though Vayoratapi Manaso Muni Pundavana, even though they may travel at the speed of mind, or they may be expert at, as Prabhupada calls it, drilling the respiration. Basically, we're talking about pranayama. Real yoga begins after hatha yoga. It's asana. Hatha yoga is actually called asana yoga, practice of different asanas. A lot of Westerners think that yoga means this hatha yoga, but these are all preliminary processes. The real beginning of meditation is pranayama, when you start to control the breathing process. Pratyahara, withdrawing the senses from the sense objects, and dharana, focusing the mind, jnana, meditation, and then samadhi, complete absorption. But maybe in India you'll find some people who know this Ashtanga yoga and practice it. At least in form, they practice it properly. But because they have no idea what their goal is, they have no understanding of the destination. They expect through their senses they will discover somewhere along the path, they'll discover the destination. It's like you get in a plane and, you know, you're flying along and then you realize, ah, I want to go to Tokyo. You're already headed to New York. It doesn't work that way. You've got to know your destination before you even get started. So here, Lord Brahma, he knows the destination, the lotus feet of Krishna, and he is an authority. He's a Mahajana, so we can take advantage of him, whether we, of course, we're not, in one sense, we are all of the same family. Lord Brahma is our creator. He's the original creator in the universe. But in another sense, we're so far removed from him, our qualities of meditation, concentration, supernatural power, austerity, adoration, and renunciation are very minuscule. Now, oftentimes you will find in a radio station, they'll have the radio tower where the radio station is situated, and they'll have a certain radius where they can broadcast. Maybe it's 100 miles, or maybe it's 500 miles, and they'll have booster stations, or booster antennas, or whatever. What do they call them? Booster? Booster. Okay. And what that does is the signal is coming from the primary radio tower is picked up by the booster, and it's again pushed out, so they can expand the radius of their the length of their broadcast. So Lord Brahma is our original guru, especially in our sampradaya. We're directly in the line of Brahma, but all the way along there are boosters. We call them acharyas or and they take the initial instructions and revitalize them and pass them on to us. So within the body of Srila Prabhupada we saw deep meditation, mental concentration, even supernatural power, certainly austerity. He's defining austerity here, and adoration, renunciation. He was very renounced. Renunciation is not always the classic model of somebody who walks about in a copan in the forest. The Naga Babas and the Kumbh Mela are sometimes the most, the biggest sense gratifiers in some respect. They're usually, most of them are stoned on hashish a good part of the time. Although they do live in the Himalayas naked. One devotee came to the temple, it's a little cold outside, and he took off one jacket, then he took off a second jacket, and then he had a third jacket on. We're not so good at that kind of renunciation. But we can renounce our tendency to exploit and enjoy. If we can do that much by following these regulative principles, Prabhupada calls them the regulative principles of freedom. We would think of them as the regulative principles of torture. Divine torture. No illicit sex. I have a memory once, one of my earliest memories in Krishna consciousness and bhakti yoga. I was in Vancouver in Canada. We had a little small temple there. This was 1969. And they were very cool. Three of us or four of us. First three, then four. And we used to have to hitchhike to go down Harina because we didn't have the money for a vehicle or even for public transport. We didn't want it. We wanted to save the money for the Sunday feast. So I remember hitchhiking one day, you know, in my dhoti and kurta, shaved head, tilak, you know, the whole regalia. And I got picked up by a truck driver. And, you know, I got up into his cab. And then I shut the door, got in. And he looked at me and he said, "Where are you from? The moon?" And No, and I explained what we were doing. He was driving along. And I started to explain, you know, we're devotees of Krishna, we're monks, we follow these principles. And he was shocked. He couldn't believe it. He said, how do you live? And I said, we don't have any illicit sex. He said, well, how can you do that? I said, you must do something. You must masturbate or something. He couldn't believe that we avoided sex life. And immediately, intoxication, frivolous activities, gambling. So this is our tapasya, tapo divyam putra kayena sattvam sudyad brahma sokyam tvanantam. Actually, experienced devotees will tell you that there is such a deep sweetness in living a Krishna conscious life. It is so sweet. Once you begin to taste it, first you have to recognize it, because it's a different kind of happiness than the prayas that we've been used to, the instant orgasmic type of flirtatious happiness that is here today, gone tomorrow. But this is growing, building, it's filled with joy, confidence, happiness, freedom from bewilderment. So once you begin to taste that and nourish it and nurture it to grow, it is so superior. You may sometimes still get distracted by, we've been engrossed for millions of lifetimes in gratifying the gross physical senses. Therefore, sometimes it's hard to cut that attachment. Chidyante, Hridaya Grantis, Shiyante, Sarvashankshaya. To cut the knot, the grunt, to cut that knot of affection, attachment. Well, that's not easy, but when one is able to experience a higher taste, then it's easier to give up the lower taste. Easier to. Someone was saying the other day, he was quoting Prabhupada, I believe, some reference, but if your mind gets distracted by sense gratification, and you see it once, okay, that's okay. But if you check it out twice, then you're caught. In other words, it's all right. It's possible to save yourself if you're distracted one time. You can pull back. Kurmon Ganiva Sarvasa. Like the tortoise, you can withdraw your senses, withdraw your limbs. You can have an alarm bell in your mind, you know. You feel yourself getting attracted to the objects of the senses. The alarm, it trips off an alarm. So, you know, warning, you know, if they have on Star Trek or something, you know, asteroid approaching. Okay, reverse turbo, you know, this and that. They fly away. Or they put up their force shield. So, if we're alert like that, then we can't help but come in contact with the sense objects. And we shouldn't be too distracted or too disturbed by our ongoing attraction, because as long as you have a physical body, a gross physical body, there will be attraction. But if you can taste something sweeter, if you can get a sense that there's something better than enjoyment that carries with it old age, disease, and death, and rebirth, if you can get a sense that there is happiness which is ever increasing, anandam buddhivardhanam, not only is it ever increasing, but it's an ocean. You can go deeper and deeper into it. If you can get that sense, then you can get the lower taste and pursue the higher taste. And this is called divya tapa, tapo divyam, transcendental austerity. Rishabhdev, he's got 100 sons, and of course he's emperor of the universe, and you know, a lot of opulence. So his sons, there's plenty for everybody. They can inherit tremendous wealth and facility, basically, for sense gratification. But right at the beginning, he encourages his sons that don't waste your life in the same type of gratification that the hogs and the dogs have, vidbhujam, the stool eaters. Don't waste your human form of life for that. But control your senses and mind. Engage in austerity by which you will get ananta, unlimited happiness. This is intelligence. In the Bhagavad Gita is stated that those who are too attached to seeking material possessorial enjoyment cannot reach yoga samadhi. Well, practically speaking, I've got some bad news for all of you. None of us are qualified to go back to Godhead. The only one thing we can hope for is the mercy of Srila Prabhupada. I mean Srila Prabhupada. It may come through other great personalities or endeavoring to be great personalities, but our founder Acharya is such an ocean of strength and mercy and compassion that he can take us all back to home, back to Godhead. But we really have to endeavor to do it. It's a given that we're short of the mark. I don't know, it's an English expression, but what does that mean, short of the mark? Where, how'd that come about?
Short of
the mark. Short of the mark, yes. How'd that come about?
You're just short of being to the final post. It's like in a race.
The final post is called the mark.
Yeah, the mark. It's the line that goes across.
The mark. I got it. The mark, the final, and you collapse before you get to the mark. Okay, so we're short of the mark. We're a lot better than a lot of people. We're sincerely trying, and that's our qualification. We're sincerely trying, so never give up trying. Always try your very best, even if the worst things happen. Get up and try again. Keep trying, and like the sparrow, you know, Garuda will come and help you. Prabhupada will come and help you. But I remember going to India the first time in 72. And I noticed there, and this is, you know, 1900s. You know, they were, I met one guy, he, in Calcutta, he was so enamored by America, he told me that I want to join your Hare Krishna movement as a young student. And I said, why? And he said, because when I'll be associated with so many Americans, and I'll be surrounded by them, and when I die, I'll think of America, and then in my next life, I'll be born in America. I found, despite that, I found that it was harder for them, because of their cultural upbringing, it was harder for them to break the regulative principles than it was for us to keep them. In other words, their cultural training gave them a lot of strength. Now, because of the movie industry, it was a lot of torture, because the movies were, you know, Bombay is called Bollywood. You know, Hollywood, well, Bombay is called Bollywood. They make more movies there than anywhere else in the world. And they've been getting worse and worse year by year. Back in those days, you know, if a boy and a girl were going to embrace or kiss or something, they'd, you know, the scene would develop in such a way that they'd go behind a bush and you wouldn't see them embracing, but, you know, that there'd be some kind of music, and you knew they were embracing, but it wasn't so out front. But we're exposed to animal activities practically every time we turn around. Anything they want to do, anything they want to sell, they sell it with sex. Anything they want to, any entertainment, they attract you with sex. All the movies, violence and sex. There may be a storyline in there somewhere, there may be a plot, there may be, but it's just heavily overcoated. You know, the hero's got to be, you know, Tom Hanks or this one or that one, I don't know who the latest flames are, but, or it's got to be, you know, Julia Roberts or something like that. And they've got to, there's got to be so many sex scenes, and I can't relate to it. Why people would go to a movie and sit there and watch other people have sex. You know, if you're that inspired by it, just go home and do it yourself, you know, with your husband or your girlfriend or whatever. But we're so surrounded by these images and by these impulses that actually in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says was that verse, born at the impulses of the modes of material nature. It's something about impulses born of the mode of material nature. That was the old translation, and they've slightly changed it, but or made it more grammatically correct. But the old impulses born of the modes of material nature. Well, that's what we're surrounded ourselves by the mode of passion and ignorance. It's reflecting back on us. And it's impossible, it's almost impossible to not be agitated. the only thing, that's why we have these cloistered communities. We're protecting ourselves. At least here there can be some semblance of culture and good qualities and whatever. And we want to expand these communities to include farm communities, etc., where large groups of household devotees can live in peace and can raise children in Krishna consciousness. So, such a difficult task, but it'll take time, maybe. Maybe it won't happen in our lifetime. But, maybe 100 years from now or 50 years from now, we'll have some good cultural beginnings, and we'll be able to give shelter, like the rain. We went for a walk yesterday in the rain, and we took umbrellas because I practice this austerity. These are austerities for some people, but for me anyway, and I think you can also appreciate my experiences, and I've been around the block, and I've been there, seen that, done that. I've been around the block. And as far as I'm concerned, this material world, Dukkalima Shaswatam, da-da-da-da-da, there's so many shastric guidelines, but the fact is that people are not nice to each other. Millions of people can be butchered and starve in Africa, and Europeans and Americans can send a few $1 million, and the majority of the people couldn't care less. About every 3 seconds or 4 seconds, a child dies from malnutrition, basically. So 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, another child dies every 3 seconds. Pretty good statistic, huh? Isn't that great? And it's not a good place, people torturing each other, social games and political games and violence and murder. We don't see it. So I want out of this rotten place. I don't want to be here. I don't want to come back again and have to go through the same mess again. Therefore, this desire of mine and my desire to please Srila Prabhupada, I just never met a person in my life that I could love like Srila Prabhupada. Now, I'm cold-hearted. I'm nice cube, you know. I had no affection, really, for my family members. I left home when I was, quite young. First of all, I lived in a dormitory in college, and then I left there. But I see them now regularly. I see my mother and my brother and sister, but basically just to preach to them, to help them. There's no deep, affection. Because they're still in Maya. But Srila Prabhupada was such a concerned person. He cared for me. Out of all his disciples, He cared for me. He cared for all his disciples, but each and every disciple felt a personal relationship with him. Some had a lot of association, some had no association, except through letters and other instruments. But we all felt that Prabhupada cared, and he walked his talk. He dealt with us the way he lived. He encouraged us. He never encouraged us to do something that he wasn't prepared to do. And he was deep in his realizations. So that, yes, my conviction to get out of the material world, my conviction to serve this great personality that I love with all my heart is so strong that the no's, they're insignificant. The yes is so strong that the no is insignificant. So this is austerity for some people, but it's actually, these are regulative principles of freedom. They will free you from attachment. Bhogasvarya prasaktanam prayaparita cetasam. When one is engrossed in material enjoyment and material opulence, he can't see beyond his gross senses. He can't. He won't be able to. Many people saw Srila Prabhupada as just an old man from an interesting cultural background. They didn't see him as their ever well wisher, their guide and master. How many people? 2,000 people out of all the traveling and preaching, so many audiences he spoke to through direct lectures or through his books, etc. Even to this day, how many books have we distributed in Holland? So many books over the years, so many books. And yet how many people are able to digest it and take it seriously? It's rare. These are the characteristics of Lord Brahma, and they're the ornaments of a sadhu. So this is Maitreya's teaching to Vidura. Are there any questions, comments?
Okay. Yeah. I was reading that Prabhupada said we should chant his japa one round in 5 to 6 minutes. He said fast, but then he said it's not possible in the beginning. So how...
Who said that?
It's Prabhupada.
Yeah. Where did he say that?
This is from Prabhupada Nectar.
That's from, okay. The Nectar of Instruction?
No, Prabhupada Nectar.
Bindu. Okay.
Then,
Amrita Bindu or something it's called.
Then what is recommended for someone in the beginning, or what can one to speculate himself, how fast, how slow he should
be? Well, I don't think speed is to be emphasized. I think more people should be trained to hear the sound of the holy name. And if they find that their mind is wandering too much, then they're probably not chanting properly. Of course, your mind will always wander, but from wherever and whenever the mind wanders, one has to bring it back under the control of the self. But I think should encourage beginners just to chant one round. And they can take as long as they like, but make it quality. This is the way to do anything. To start a business, you should start it in a small way. Micro, as a micro, as a microcosmic way. And get everything nicely organized. Become familiar with every aspect of your business. Give quality service, quality product. Get a good name. Then you expand it into a macro and it becomes very easy. Because you just, the same principles, but you just expand it. Once an industrialist, a big industrialist, one of the wealthiest in Bombay, he told me, he said, it takes as much effort to run a tea stall, it takes as much effort to run a tea plantation and a tea empire as it does to run a tea stall. It's just a question of, you know, your vision. The same energy requires. But first of all, you should know, should get experience on how to run a tea stall. Then you'll be able to deal effectively with the large empire. First, people should chant and hear correctly the sound of the holy name. Emphasize that we're not trying to, you know, see the gopis, and we're not trying to realize ourselves to be Krishna. We're just trying to hear the sound of the holy name. It will have its own effect. You don't need to worry how it is working. It will have its own effect. But you chant clearly and purely as you gain confidence. As you get inspiration, then you increase in quantity and speed, etc. I never encourage people to chant at a particular speed. If they, if they can chant immediately at 5 minutes, why would you tell them to chant at 10 minutes? You don't know where they're coming from or what their aptitude is. What do you do?
It varies.
Huh?
It varies from month to year to year.
It varies from month to month and year to year?
Yeah.
What you tell people?
No, what I thought, did you, how I tell myself.
Oh, no, you were talking about...
Oh, anything that I...
I wouldn't leave it open-ended. I would emphasize the right thing and tell them this is our goal to chant. And tell them why. The fact is, if you can chant around in 5 or 6 minutes... it's probably the best situation for your own concentration. Now, if you listen to Prabhupada, he's much faster than 5 minutes. In fact, he doesn't breathe in between individual mantras. What he does is, at least from what I've heard, on the japa tape, he's like, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, you know, there'll be a portion of the mantra which he won't say as loud as the rest of the mantra, and at that time he's putting less energy into sound, into repeating the sound, and he takes a little breath of air. But he goes continuously through. And by the time, if you're trying to follow him, you'll find after about, you know, 30 seconds or something, he's way ahead of you. So that's another level. And people always say that in India, hear this all the time. People speculate that one, by chanting japa, you're automatically practicing pranayama. Well, maybe there's some truth to that too. But I would just tell people this is the goal, and this has to do with everything that we teach, even what we discuss amongst ourselves. In the latter days, the recent days, there is a group of disoriented, disaffected, bewildered people who think that Prabhupada made a mistake, that the regulative principles are too difficult to follow, and we should just chant Hare Krishna and be what we feel we are. Or we should lower the standard. And that's complete stupid thing to say. It's something somebody dreamed up without any brain power. Here's our standard, and it's been adjusted already. Bhakti Siddhanta said someone who doesn't chant 64 rounds is patita, or fallen. But Prabhupada has given us 16 rounds, and this is the standard. And no intoxication, no illicit sex, etc. So, if you say, well, it's too hard, so we'll lower it to 8 rounds, there's always going to be a group of people who say, well, that's too much. So, you know, you're here, the standard's here, and some people are down here, so you lower it down here. They'll go down here. You lower it down here. They'll go down here. And, you know, by the time you look again, you're on the ground. You're just base animals pretending to be Krishna conscious. You have to have some desire. You have to have some strength. And you have. And if someone can't follow the regulative principles, that doesn't mean we take them out back and shoot them. We can still be friends. We can still be civil. We can still be gentlemen. It's an individual thing. My relationship with Krishna is my personal relationship with Krishna. And there's no person who's going to, you know, make me feel bad about it. I will feel bad if I'm, you know, that I can't follow the standard. But I'm not going to get, you know, too often people protect themselves by criticizing others. They're weak and they take shelter of the fact that they're card-carrying members of the institution and they're holier than thou, and, you know, they pontificate and look down their noses. But then you see, you know, 3 years later, the same guys out on the street, you know, in a worse position than I ever was. But before, he was telling me, you know, so many things. So I think that we have to, you be tough on yourself and easy on others. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't discuss, but I think it has to be done in a loving way. Certainly we should speak the truth as far as we understand it, but it really should be with the mood of love and help and friendship and camaraderie and just not, people would, you know, these people are overreacting because they followed in some, they got into, you know, they didn't follow the regulative principles because they were encouraged in a loving way. It was just kind of an order, and if you didn't follow it, you were looked down upon by the community, and you were made to feel like a rotten apple. And this should be a community of love. We should give our hearts and we should give people a loving environment where they can feel comfortable and happy. We shouldn't compromise with our standards, and we shouldn't, you know, tell people that this is the ideal standard, and if you want to live in the ashram, this is the standard you have to follow. But you can live outside, and we'll still be friends, and I'll still share prasadam with you, and you know, I'll still listen and spend time with you, but please try to come to the standard. I think it's good for you. I think it will benefit you. And it will. But I am a person, and Tina can tell you, I've always been a strong preacher of sadhana. I believe, especially for myself, I believe in the importance of sadhana. But over the last couple of years, I've had a really, really difficult time chanting my rounds, following the principles, means getting up in the morning. Principles, that's all right, that's fine. But because of my disease, you know, you cannot imagine the pain and difficulty my body has gone through. And I've tried, but there were weeks and even months on end when I couldn't chant. I wouldn't get time. I would be asleep half the time, or I gave my time to dealing with people and sharing with people and encouraging people, and I didn't get time to chant. Now that I've got a little improvement in my health, I'm stabilizing. But I can just see, you know, the institution. Oh, Sridhar Swami doesn't do this or doesn't do that. Off with his head. You know. The regulative principles are important. Everything is important. But you know what's more important? The heart. The intention. If you love people, then you'll be sensitive to their love, and you'll recognize a devotee. Of course, we have to avoid demons. We have to be compassionate to innocent people. But you just don't know how wonderful Srila Prabhupada was and how much compassion and love he had. He's the only one who can take us all back to Godhead. Granthara Srimad Bhagavatam.